That's Jimmy Smith, the king of the Hammond jazz organ, with The Sermon, a 20-minute title track on the Blue Note album of the same name, released in 1958, with Lee Morgan on trumpet, Lou Donaldson on alto sax, Harold Floyd, also known as Tina Brooks, on tenor sax, Kenny Burrell on guitar, and Art Blakey on drums. This is Lead Stories. I'm Utrice Lead. It is Thursday, April the 17th, and we get started with our program today with an FYI. FYIs are just recently introduced on Lead Stories as peer-to-peer teaching and learning. And today, our peer-to-peer teacher is Jay Smith. Jay, are you with us? Is he there?
Yes. Hi, Richard. Can you hear me?
Great. Tell us a little about yourself.
Well, Richard, I'm a longtime environmental activist, and I am now deeply involved in the urban agriculture movement, which I got into because of my interest in the subject we're going to talk about today. I work in the bureaucracy of a well-known university, and I'm a devoted fan of One Year to Sleep.
I think we are both devoted fans of the program. That's great. So what are you going to be talking to us about today? What's your FYI on today?
Peak oil.
Peak oil.
P-E-A. Oil. Yes, we're going to take a P-E-E-K peak at peak oil today.
Okay. Well,
and I hope I can P-I-Q-U-E your interest.
My God. Oh, Lord. That was good, but I tell you, I couldn't have thought of all three at the same time. I would have had to take a couple of days to put that together. All right, so get started on peak oil.
Okay. Just first a little caveat. Peak oil is a rather complex and I think emotionally challenging subject. And I'm going to just approach it very simply. This is just a very simple introduction to the idea. And for those who may be more knowledgeable about peak oil, I'm obviously not going to go into any great depth. We're just defining it denotatively and with some connotation. peak oil obviously contains the term oil. And oil, as we know, is something that is probably pervasive in our economy. Not probably, it is. It is a primary fuel resource for our contemporary global economy. Oil is a finite, non-renewable resource. And oil geologists estimate that there may have been 2 trillion barrels of recoverable oil globally. We have consumed approximately half of that, about 1 trillion barrels. And while there is some, there are theories that, you know, it's called an abiotic theory of oil, where oil is continually and chemically being made in the depths of the earth. There's really little evidence for this, and most geologists believe that oil was created millions of years ago from decomposed plant and algae organisms, and through great heat and pressure became what we know of as oil. So it is a finite resource on the planet. So peak oil means that point in time when the maximum rate of petroleum extraction is reached. The point in time when the maximum rate, that word rate is very important in peak oil, the point in time when the maximum rate of extraction is reached, after which the rate of production enters irreversible terminal decline. This decline is true for an individual oil well, an oil field, an oil province or region, and now the globe. Geologists generally agree that the volume of oil is depleting globally. The debate is about when the decline will be severe enough to impact our global economy. Most oil geologists in the world are now thinking, along with the International Energy Agency, that the world peaked in oil production in 2005-2006. One of the interesting things about peak oil is that it can only be definitively known in retrospect, given the complex array of data to be analyzed. But it appears that we may have peaked in 2005. There are some who think that we have some time to go. Peak oil is not the idea that we are soon running out of oil. We're not going to run out of oil anytime soon. It is rather the idea that the cheap, inexpensive, easily recoverable conventional oil, what is sometimes called sweet crude, in the world has been extracted. And what remains to be extracted requires more effort and energy to locate. They're often in remote locations like offshore ocean beds, icy landscapes, and difficult terrain, and requires special technologies like hydrofracking, which was part of your FYI before, to get at difficult geological formations like shale, or the tar sands, which requires inordinately vast quantities of water. And also, it takes a lot more energy. It takes energy to get energy. That's usually referred to as energy return on energy invested. And so the more we have to search for oil and go to these remote locations to get it, the more energy it takes and the greater the cost. I want to offer as an example of what I'm describing our own United States, which was the world's first major oil producer and leading exporter after the first well was drilled in Titusville, Pennsylvania in 1859. Discoveries in oil in the 48 states of the United States peaked in the 1930s, that is to say, the rate of discovering oil wells and so on came to a peak in the 1930s, and from then on, they found fewer and fewer wells. And oil production for the United States peaked in 1970-71. And ever since, the U.S. has been has had to increase its imports of oils to the point where it became a net importer for two-thirds of its oil, of the oil we consume. We consume about 22 million barrels a day. The recent boom in domestic fracking for oil has temporarily diminished that foreign dependency to about 50-50 domestic to foreign, but it is anticipated that we will soon be back on the down curve. Another meaning of peak oil is that if this process of discovery, production, and decline is charted on a graph, it resembles a mountain or an inverted U, which graph statisticians call a bell curve. We'll call it a mountain. And the gentleman who developed the mathematical method for analyzing and charting oil production and depletion data was a famed geophysicist and mathematician named M. King Hubbert. M. King Hubbert, after whom this charting of oil is named, hence the Hubbert curve. And if you were to create a chart, a graph of what I've just described to you about the United States, we would be at the peak of the Hubbert mountain, we'll call it a mountain, globally. That is to say, the world is now where the United States was in 1970. And what we're looking at is an increasing declining rate of oil production globally. So one other thing about peak oil is that the term does not only, I've given you an operational denotation or definition of peak oil. But peak oil also encompasses the connotation of the rather staggering implication from oil depletion on the global economy, in which this really vital energy and petrochemical resource is so essential and extensive. The decline in the rate of oil production necessarily results in a decline in the rate at which that energy from oil can be distributed and converted into economic activity. So peak oil analysts are particularly concerned about the future of transportation and food production, which actually uses a lot more oil than transportation does. But so I think I'll stop there in terms of defining peak oil, and I would just like to offer to the audience, for if you would like to research this further, there are some websites that I think can illustrate what I'm talking about very well. One is www.resilience, R-E-S-I-L-I-E-N-C-E, www.resilience.org. Another is www.peakoil, one term, peakoil.net. There was a document that was produced for the Department of Energy in 2005 called Peaking of World Oil Production, Impact Mitigation and Risk Management by Robert Hirsch. He was the lead author, hence it's called the Hirsch Report. His name is spelled H-I-R-S-C-H. Peaking of World Oil Production, Impact Mitigation and Risk Management commissioned by the Department of Energy in 2005. I recommend that to everyone. It shows that the U.S. government is aware of this topic. And there are two documentaries that are available on YouTube that I think are really insightful about this topic. One is The Power of Community. The Power of Community. It's about the special period in Cuba when Cuba lost the oil subsidy from the Soviet Union, and it addresses the peak oil question. And another is Crude Awakening, C-R-U-D-E, Crude Awakening. Two excellent documentaries for further insight into this stunning topic. As I think I told you, Yutris, I was absolutely, it's one of the most stunning intellectual discoveries of my life when I discovered this some almost 15 years ago. And the other stunning thing is that we're not talking about it. And as a man of color, I think it's particularly important that people of color look into this subject and start preparing.
Well, thank you so much, Jay, for bringing us that information on peak oil. Of mm-hmm. course, with FYIs, the idea is to, again, I'm going to steal some of what Jay Smith just shared with us, is to pique, P-I-Q-U-E, our interests about subjects that require further examination and thought. So thank you so much for bringing that to us today.
Thank you.
All right. If you have an idea that you have been looking into a particular subject and you think you have a good handle on it and you'd like to present it for FYI, which is, again, our feature here that we just started. Jay Smith's presentation today is only the second FYI we're doing on peer-to-peer teaching and learning. Please do drop me a line at leadstories@gmail.com. And now we hear about a really incredible and very disturbing story from a colleague of mine, Paul DiRienzo. Paul, you're with us?
Hi, I'm here. Thank you, Yutris.
Thank you. Well, tell us what you're going to be sharing with us today.
Well, I've been working on a grant that I received from the George Polk Awards here in Long Island University in New York to investigate the Hanford nuclear site, which is a 600 square mile, about 50% bigger than New York City, site along the Columbia River in central Washington state, which was established in 1942 and 1943 to manufacture plutonium for the Fat Man atomic bomb that was dropped on Japan in 1945. And then later went on to be the site where up to 9 nuclear reactors were used to produce plutonium for the Cold War, the American nuclear strategic arsenal of many, many, many thousands of atomic bombs. The plutonium fuel for that was produced at Hanford. And in the course of many decades of top secret classified activity, which is little understood or known by the people who worked there, much less who lived around the area, a massive amounts of waste were released into the Columbia River, into the soil, and into the air. And currently, the legacy of nuclear weapons production stopped in the late 1980s at the end of the Cold War, and currently there are 177 waste tanks dating back from the 1940s till the 1960s and 70s, which hold 56 million or 60 million gallons of nuclear waste, which contain 350 million curies of radiation, which is about double the amount of radiation released by the Chernobyl disaster. And in many ways, it's called America's Fukushima. And so it's constantly in the news media and is in the news media today because many of your listeners, Yutris, might be following the fact that there have been numerous whistleblowers who have told about ongoing, very, very serious ongoing problems with the $100-plus billion cleanup, which will take at least 100 years, if it's even doable at all, which is run by the great contractor, the giant contractor Bechtel, working for the Department of Energy, which controls the site in Hanford. And some of these people who have been whistleblowers and have received have lost their jobs and had very, very serious things happen to them and are involved in all kinds of lawsuits and were recently featured in a Senate panel, which is looking into what's going on. Walter Tamasitis, for example, who raised concerns that the shortcuts and the cleanup could lead to leaks, explosions, fires, criticality, where enough plutonium is concentrated in the cleanup process itself or within the pipes or tanks that actually a nuclear reaction could actually begin within the actual cleanup facility. And others, Donna Bushy was a safety officer, also fired from her job. And they were, you know, these are becoming somewhat infamous stories of employee safety, employees and top engineers being relegated to basement offices without a window and being treated as pariahs by the people around them until they're finally fired. These are becoming almost apocryphal type stories, and movies are being made of them. Basic problem, I think, behind a lot of it, you know, the reasons why these employees are told to don't raise issues is because of the nature of the contract that Bechtel and its subcontractors have, which is called a cost-plus contract, and which has been likened in many ways to giving the fox the hen house or a license to steal. I think Walter Tamasitis, one of the famous whistleblowers, called it a license to steal. It means that you get the basic cost, whatever that might be, going on forever of your project, and then they give you a profit payment on top of that, with including incentive payments, which basically the incentive is for you to never finish the project. And right now the central project is the waste vitrification plant, and the waste vitrification plant is supposed to take huge amounts, these millions and millions of gallons of highly radioactive waste, incredibly dangerous. I think one Dixie cup could kill everybody in a room full of people, in like a supermarket or something. One little tiny bit that's microscopic on the leg of a fruit fly caused a whole 20-acre site to be evacuated.
I think it's a good time to let people know, Paul, that you'll be filing an ongoing series on this particular topic, which you've titled America's Fukushima. We're talking about Hanford, this town on the banks of, as it were, of the Columbia River in Washington State. So let's start at the very beginning. What is the total number of reactors that comprise the Hanford site?
They were nine were eventually built between 1942 or 1943 and 1964. The ninth one went into operation. The B reactor is the only one that still stands. I mean, others are in various conditions of being ripped down and torn down, but you can't even enter them to finish the decommissioning process for 75 years. All they have to do, most of them are just covered over to protect them from the rain, and that they can never even approach them for another 75 years until the radiation dies down within them. But the B reactor, they put a lot of money into that, and that was the original one, and that's actually preserved as a museum. And last October, during the celebrations of the 70th anniversary of the beginning of the Manhattan Project, I went to Richland, Washington. Hanford no longer exists. The people there were forced to move by the Manhattan Project. They had no idea. They were bought out. Their farms were dug up, and they were driven out and given small payments for their land, and a top-secret classified facility was replaced them. They had no idea what was going on there. A sort of American, Soviet-style American secret atomic city was constructed, which still exists, called Richland, and the Tri-Cities area, and that's where the workers lived. And 50,000 plus workers during those days of the Manhattan Project, and that's where they produce in a very incredibly disgustingly, I have to use the adjective, tremendously polluting methodology was used at the time, and untold tons of waste were dumped into the river, into the air, into the water in order to produce the plutonium, about 2 or 3 or 4. Kilograms of plutonium, which were created to drop on Nagasaki, Batman bomb, which was used on Nagasaki.
So this was a site where the government produced its nuclear arsenal, essentially.
Yes, two-thirds of all the plutonium.
And that included, as you mentioned, the nuclear bombs dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
Just Nagasaki. The Hiroshima bomb was based on uranium, and that was manufactured at Oak Ridge, Tennessee.
Oh, wow. That's a very good distinction to make. I didn't know that.
That's a good point, though, Eutrice, you bring up, because the United States was turned into, in the 1940s, and continuing through the Cold War, the entire United States became a gigantic nuclear weapons producing factory. An institution, and people don't realize that it was at one point the nuclear bomb manufacturing system was bigger than the United States auto industry, and yet totally classified.
Now, how or why did they choose that particular site?
Because of they needed cold river water to cool the reactors, and they had a fast-moving cold river, and it was an incredibly remote spot at that time. The land was very cheap. And when the Manhattan Project officials flew over in a small plane, they saw it immediately. It happened to also be a sacred spot of the Yakima Indians, who were among the local Indian groups there, which are one of the few Indian groups in America that can trace their heritage in the place where they live today back 10 and 12 and 13,000 years.
And what has happened to that particular group since the location of the site and even up until this day?
Well, it's sort of very similar. As a matter of fact, there's a fascinating book by Kate Brown called Plutopia about the Soviet version, which is a city called Ozersk in the southern Urals of Russia. The United States and the Soviet Union built secret atomic cities, whether Oak Ridge or Hanford. It's Richland, which is really the city near Hanford. They call it tri-cities today. Los Alamos. And these large laboratories like Livermore National Laboratory, and in some places like Rocky Flats, Colorado, Fernald, Ohio, Pantex near Amarillo, Texas, and these became a top secret operation. Today, the United States and the Soviet Union and Russia have reduced their nuclear arsenal somewhat, but they've also modernized them, and the U.S. operates what is called the stockpile conservation program, something like that, and that's what they are not really supposed to be modernizing their weapons, but they are. And we know that both the United States and Russia have been modernizing their nuclear weapons to a more. They like them to be smaller nowadays. They don't want to have big, 50 megaton bombs anymore. Now they have like ones that could destroy New York, half of Manhattan in a heartbeat. They consider that small.
And what caused the decision to decommission the site?
Because, good question again, you treat it. In 19, Karen Dorn Steele from the N newspaper, she was really trying to find out what there were so many reports of people were getting sick from the poison. They're poisoning their thyroid gland, and they were called downwinders, and they were constantly, these stories and these complaints were going on, and so, hello?
Yes, listening.
Hello. Oh, it's still there. Sorry, I thought I left.
I listen hard.
Yeah, and she kept looking and really being she's like sort of my impetus in this story, Karen Dorn Steele from the Spokane Review. She really started hitting with Freedom of Information Act. I've been doing the same Freedom of Information Act, trying to find out the history of it, what happened at different times in the history, the 70-year history now of Hanford. The government finally responded in 1986 and released, at that time, many tens of thousands of pages. It's grown now to like hundreds of thousands of pages of formally classified documents that was the first time in 1986 anybody knew any of this stuff. And now I've out of those documents, which is very interesting, and learned a lot by going through all of those documents and helped me to understand what's happened in the history of Hanford. And we barely know a fraction of really what happened. And there's many, many secrets still to be found out about what went on there over all those decades. And immediately, one of the first things that came out was that the government had purposely and consciously allowed huge amounts of radiation to be released into the environment to study what would happen to the people. And one was called the Green Run Experiment, where they mimicked the more primitive methodologies by the Soviets in order to better calibrate their detection equipment. And so they released large amounts of radioactive iodine over eastern Washington State, including Spokane, Walla Walla, all those cities. And many people were dosed. And then, of course, the native people who lived closest to the river and lived off of the river and ate the fish and all the parts of the fish that the whites wouldn't touch got a significantly higher dose over that period of time. And then they would send guys in white, you know, they come and pick up your urine. You'd have to, people who lived there would leave their urine in bottles every morning, and people would come in trucks, you know, nondescript trucks and white suits. They'd pick up your urine from in front of your house and stuff. And they did, people participated often in human experimentation at that time because they felt it was their patriotic duty.
Well, between 1968 and 1987, when the plant was phased out, that still did not solve the problem, because now you have the largest amount of nuclear waste to dispose of. What has happened to the waste?
Right, that's another great story. The waste, it's complex. Certain types of waste cannot be moved. It has to be left where it is because there has no waste repository that's been established in the United States. So, for example, most of the commercial nuclear reactors have relatively small amounts of high-activity waste. And commercial plants are kept in what swimming pools are called, on the actual property of the plant, and they're not allowed to move them. You're not allowed to move waste without a actual location to move it to, and no location has been approved by Congress. Defense waste, which is huge amounts, but lower activity because of the methods they use in defense reactors, are to be stored at the waste isolation pilot plant near Carlsbad, New Mexico, which is a gigantic underground salt mine that was hollowed out and turned into a nuclear repository that's supposed to hold nuclear waste for 250,000 years. All right? And that means that future generations, what we're doing, we are communicating to future generations what we thought of them, you know, what we do here. You know, thousands of years from now, whatever type of people are around, 100,000 years from now are going to be in for some serious surprises if they go digging around in some parts of the world. And that they have no idea. And who's to say there'll be more? Everybody thinks it's a straight line. There might be troubles in the future, and new races of people could rise and could be just as innocent and nice as we are, which is a little bit different. And this is the present we left up from our time. And so we're speaking to the future, way into the future. We're seeing, this is like science fiction. We're speaking to people hundreds of thousands of years from now who will inhabit this planet. We have no idea what they'll be like or what their history will be. And they're going to find a present from us that they'll never forget.
But even so, the waste is there. It doesn't mean that it's not going anywhere. At some point, one would expect that there would be erosion into the soil and leaching into the water tables and probably even seeping through the earth and finding its way back into the air. Guarantees are there that the waste is being safely disposed of, or is that even possible to safely dispose of the kind of nuclear waste that comes from building plutonium nuclear weapons?
Yeah, no, there's no way. In fact, at the waste isolation plant, it's supposed to last for 100,000 years, and 12 years in, it had a massive explosion just a couple months ago. And it didn't get any real coverage of the media, not nationwide. And plutonium was detected on the surface, you know, to the Native American communities and the poor people. You know, Carlsbad is a very poor area. They took the waste isolation pilot saying nobody else wanted it. They said, no way, Washington State told them again, we're never taking another thing from you ever again in Washington State. And that's part of the fight up there in Hanford, because some people want to turn Hanford, well, you'll never clean it up, so let's turn it into a waste dump, you know, for the government. You know, let it go into the river. Radiation won't do anything bad to you. It's diluted. You know, dilution is the solution, right? That's what they say. Dilution is the solution. And just diluted, and it won't matter anymore. Like Fukushima going into the Pacific Ocean. Eventually the Pacific Ocean will dilute all that radiation, and it'll be nothing. But anyway, plutonium, one little tiny microscopic speck, will cause lung cancer. And anybody who gets it in their lungs.
Are people living within close proximity, even though the plant has been decommissioned? I still see from pictures that they've posted radioactive warnings on the fences. So are people allowed to live within some degree of proximity to this plant?
Well, in New Mexico, they do. They're forced to. And in Hanford, they sort of want to. I mean, some people are patriotic Americans whose parents and grandparents worked on the Manhattan Project, and they continue to live there. And they consider it a proud thing to do. I mean, there are people who totally take an opposite view than the one we're expressing here, and think that these corporations are doing the best they can, and that the whistleblowers are harassing them. The corporation is doing the best job they can, and that it can only be paid for this way, right? But in fact, there is no guarantee of anything. I mean, there was a crack in the dam 20 miles up of Hanford, upstream of Hanford, out of nowhere, one of the great hydroelectric dams across the river, which has a huge lake behind it. On a sunny day failure, a 65-foot crack appeared in the dam. And one day, like in February. And they had to draw down the lake 150 feet.
I mean, this thing sounds like, you know, a really made-up story. It doesn't even sound real, but of course it's real. But I want to talk to you about you. I want to talk to you about you, Paul.
Yes.
You get yourself involved in these kinds of stories, and that's been your history over the years. Why do you do these kinds of stories?
Oh, I want to know. I Glenn Greenwald gave a press conference the other day, and he said something that I have to endorse. They know so much about us, and we know so little about them. You know, the public goes about thinking we live in a democracy, and we now know it's really an oligarchy, and an oligarchy rules, and we're not even sure, you know, behind these political figures who are like mouthpieces for mouthpieces for mouthpieces, who really is pulling the strings. And what their plan is, you know. And I think that how can you have a democracy unless you have whistleblowers who try and get to the heart of what's going on? And who is it that's in charge? Who's calling the shots? And what is their plan? And what is our role in their plan, you know? And you know, I thought we were supposed to be in a democracy, and we're not. And I guess I can't think of any greater, you know, I look back on American history back to John Brown and back to the more credible of the founding fathers, you know, even in the early days, into the French Revolution, into the revolution in Haiti, you know, that gave us our democratic society that we have today, as imperfect as it is. And I wonder, you know, can this long endure, you know, with these circumstances without the knowledge and the information that's necessary to survive? And what other purpose is there? Why live? Why breathe the air? You know, why be a target for radioactive poisoning? You know, Why are we here? Just to live in a ranch house in Tupelo? I mean, there's got to be more to it. And to me, it's all about knowing and finding out, you know, what's going on. And it's not in a church, you know, it's not in a cathedral, it's not in a temple. It's, you know, in the information and the facts of what's really going on.
So far, what have you discovered that really, really startled you?
I don't know if it startled me. The most startling and significant thing about Hanford is that it is a permanent message of our time to the future. And the second was I was just fascinated by the relationship of the Native of the first white settlers in that region to the Native Americans, and the brutality to which they were treated in the 1850s. And I think a lot, you know, the Native people there would never have allowed this to happen if they hadn't been broken and smashed and destroyed 100 years earlier. You know, if war hadn't been made on peaceful people who wanted nothing but to live their lives where they had always lived them for thousands of years, if they had been given the respect and they had the power that they should have had, this never would have happened. They never would have allowed it. The Manhattan Project was unnecessary. the atom bomb was unnecessary. There's more than a little bit of information that the Truman Committee would have had Leslie Groves and the leaders and Oppenheimer and all these people would have been taken and arrested for running the biggest boondoggle in American history. And that they dropped those bombs so they wouldn't be arrested for wartime corruption. The entire Manhattan Project was the biggest wartime corruption in American history, and they're still, and it's almost like they ensured that people like Bechtel and these companies would have business for generations to come on a cost-plus basis.
Well, Paul, you've given us a really good overview of what we can expect in the coming installations right here on the topic of America's Fukushima. You've been working on the story for some time under a Polk Awards journalism grant, and I know you're in it, you know, up to your ears in working on this story. So I hope that this gives the audience a kind of taste of where the story is going to go once you start filing these stories with us. So thank you so much for being with us and giving us this tour today.
Could I give you my webpage?
Sure.
YouTube.com/letemtalk, LETEMTALK. So it's a YouTube page, and it's Let Them Talk, Let Them Talk, LETEMTALK. And my name is Paul DiRienzo, DiRienzo. Just search it, and you'll find my stuff all over Google. Thank you.
Thanks, Paul. We'll see you with your new installment soon. Thank you. Well, that gives us just an overview. We had two overviews today, two FYIs, a short one and a pretty long one. This story by Paul DiRienzo is going to be really dramatic, and we learn a lot about how governments deceive and abuse their people, all in the name of democracy. And, of course, it's a really chilling story. Here in the nice, quiet, scenic banks of the river, the Columbia River, a place that was carefully chosen by the First Nations people who lived there, the government decided, well, here's a nice place for what we need, and of course, being democratic, decided to build a permanently toxic presence and forcing people to live with the consequences of it. Even today, although the reactors had been deactivated between 1968 and 1987, it is, as Paul was saying, an everlasting gift of death and toxicity. And we have to understand these things. We really do. It's an extraordinary story. And I know Paul, his energy, once he gets into a story, he sticks with it like a bulldog until it gets told. And I want to thank Jay Smith as well for bringing us up to snuff on an FYI, peer-to-peer teaching and learning on the issue of peak oil. If you want to do FYIs, as I said, you just drop me a note and let me know what your area of interest is. We'll talk a bit about what it is you want to do, and we'll present it. This is another way of using the airwaves, because we all have some kind of information or expertise that we can share. I want to go back to the discussion yesterday. I got a lot of feedback from listeners on that little element, that wonderful little exchange between Bill O'Reilly and the basketball coach for Kentucky, John Calipari, I believe it was. Having this discussion ostensibly about the coach's new book. But of course, they didn't discuss the book. And what it showed was, and I was hoping somebody would get that as the real answer, but everybody came very, very close. It was great that you picked it up, the points that were so subtle. And there were, of course, points that you couldn't avoid because they were so out there, you know, the racism in society. Some people, like Bill O'Reilly, they just don't care to cover it up. They don't even bother to cover it up. It's just there in your face. But on the guest, the coach was the other flip side of racism, and that is the benign condescension and the benign tolerance of it. Nowhere in the discussion did we have the coach take the host to task for saying some outrageous things. Maybe it was because, well, you know, it was free time on a Fox News network, gave him 5 minutes to talk about his book, and perhaps he made a decision that if he offended the host in any way, he would not get his 5 minutes of free publicity. But what you saw and what I wanted to bring to people's attention was that very thing. We have racism that is overt, and we have racism that is covert. And so in a conversation like that, you tend to say, well, it was Bill O'Reilly who was really the offender, but actually he was not the only offender. The two men had something in common, and that is they did not see that they were talking about these members of a basketball team, young men, but they were men. They were African-American men, but they kept referring to them as kids. And essentially, the discussion kind of sounded like, so how do you keep your guys on the plantation? How do you police them and make sure they do the right thing? That was one level of it. But a very important significance of that story was that, and it's ironic, and we'll get into that shortly. I think I'm going to try to schedule something soon so we could talk about that. I wanted to illustrate the point that it was a tremendously ironic thing that here we have Bill O'Reilly of Irish stock, and we have the coach, John Calipari, of Italian heritage. And neither of them spoke as if they ever recognized that the ethnic groups from which they came and from which they come were themselves ostracized in the society as not being white. The Irish, as a matter of fact, there's a book where the Irish became How the Irish Became White by Noel Ignatieff. And we've had lectures here by John Perry. I believe I'm mixing up the first name. I know I'm just remembering the last name, Perry, who has reissued the works of Theodore Allen on the invention of the white race. We've had discussions of the work of Ian Haney Lopez, White by Law, discussing how bizarre the U.S. Supreme Court has been in deciding this notion of whiteness. But we had agreement between these two representatives of these two ethnic groups agreeing tacitly that they they're now superior to the group that they were discussing as almost as modern-day slaves in a huge industry in which their only job is to provide a good living for others. It's a very deep thing. And those were the things I was hoping that we would be able to point out about that discussion, that the irony of it all is that not too long ago, Bill O'Reilly would never have been permitted to put his foot in the door of Fox News, and never would John Calipari have had the opportunity to be in charge of anything, because both groups were deemed less than in this race-based society. So when you hear these kinds of conversations, it is important to remember that although people may have differing points of view, when it comes to this notion of who is superior to whom, there generally is immediate consensus. They both decide, well, We are in charge. We are above these folks that we're talking about. We don't need to recognize their humanity. We don't need to recognize their validity and the contribution to our society at all. And that, my friends, is the great irony of discussions like those. Well, I want to thank you for joining me today. It's been a mostly an FYI kind of day, hasn't it? We've had a very good tour of what's to come on the program. I want to thank you so much for your feedback and your words of encouragement and your participation in the program. It makes me feel really good to know that the program is useful and that it has value to you and to others. So thank you so much for that. You do me great honor by relating to the program, relating to the program that way. Thank you so much. Tomorrow, of course, is Free Your Mind Friday, and let's hope you do exactly that, free your mind. So from me to you today, I want to thank you so much for all that you contribute to this program. And I just want to say, too, please do support PRN FM because it is a viable avenue of information and a viable vehicle of communication. And it will become more and more important as the decision is made by entities that they don't need to necessarily take care of people's unique informational needs. They can decide that they would do service to the powers that be instead and lock out the needs of people who really utilize a medium just the way we are, which is to talk with each other, to share ideas with each other, to bring to each other's attention stories of great importance, knowledge that we necessarily need in order to navigate our society with some degree of intelligence. So please do support the station and let them know that you're speaking up for Lead Stories, your favorite program on PRN.FM. So thanks so much for joining me today. We'll see each other tomorrow at 1 p.m. Tell somebody, and you can write me at leadstories@gmail.com and on Facebook, Lead Stories with Utrice Lead. Coming up next, Mike Fader with Occupy Territory America. Bye-bye.